If you enjoy podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Better with Dr. Erica, hosted by Dr. Erica, provides support and guidance in navigating stress-related challenges to transform your relationship to self-care. Each episode arms you with the tools needed to be better, do better, and live better. There was an incredible episode that you should check out called Touch and Connections as Tools for Healing and Better Mental Health. In this episode, her guest breaks down ways to use physical touch as a form of healing for trauma and grief. Check out Better with Dr. Erica on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. It's with a heavy heart that I bring to you the news of the passing of Al Levin, a guest of the show last season, a childhood friend of a good friend of mine, a compassionate soul, assistant principal, father of four, loving spouse, brother, son, and just a really good guy who I was myself looking forward to getting to know better. He lost his battle with depression 2 weeks ago, and it's taken me a bit to bring myself to deliver this to you all. It's a hard one to process for so many reasons. Personally, because we were close in age and had so many things in common. He was also a podcast host of the Depression Files, where he provided incredible resource over the past 6 years, exploring ways to manage and even recover from depression, an illness that for those of us who struggle with it, rules an unacceptable amount of time and mental energy in a person's life. And I was under the impression that Al had a handle on it finally after two very difficult bouts over a decade ago, which he shared with me in this recording that I'm resharing with you right now. And in listening back, I can hear some of the struggles he was having with care providers. And as a care provider, it's hard to rehear some of this. It's so easy to become disheartened by witnessing someone who was trying so hard to lose the battle with a disease that he advocated so hard for, resourcing so many people in the process. At a gathering with friends and family just a couple weeks ago, I met a guy who told me that a friend of his who served on the board with Al set him up with a call with Al when he said he was close to taking his own life and saved his life. I got a big response the last time I posted this, which was originally released in 2022. And I'm guessing it was because I don't think there's anyone who doesn't know someone who's been affected by this disease, whether it's been identified, gone untreated, or fought silently. But I'm choosing to focus today on what I learned from Al, from his bravery, from his integrity, and from the fact that he persevered as long as he did. For all his effort to bless us with what he was able to share during this time, and grateful to have had the chance that we did have together, the conversations that we had, and the people he introduced me to, who are amazing folks. You'll be missed, Al Levin. Here's our conversation. So one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you was because I feel like you've become like an ambassador for men's depression, and you know, in some ways it's funny, we were introduced through a common friend, but then it turned out that the FACEIT Foundation, Bill and Mark were people who were also supporting you early on when you were struggling. So it's such a great like lead in, but I feel like With your work now, because you've gotten so involved and you've been talking to so many different people, similar to what I feel like I go through with my podcast, I learned so much from having these conversations. And in some ways, I came into this with a health challenge, into my field with a health challenge as well. And so I'm always exploring, and I'm always kind of, because I treat people who have, so many different varieties of things, I feel like I'm trying to help them with resource at the same time. But right. It seems like that's exactly what you've gotten into with your podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always say selfishly, like, I have learned so much. You know, I started the podcast, it's called The Depression Files. I remember almost right away reaching out to somebody out who I knew online and said, hey, I know you live with bipolar disorder, so I don't think I'm going to interview you, but I know you have a podcast, you know, let's just talk about podcasting. And actually, after about my third or fourth episode, I realized, wow, these guys have everything. Like, why would I limit this to just men with depression? So I started just even marketing it as interviews with men who have lived with depression and or other mental illnesses.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to learn so much about so many different mental illnesses. That was incredible.
Yeah.
So that's the piece I love the most. And actually, in the past couple of years, I've expanded it to now what I call include deep dive conversations with guest experts on various topics of mental illness.
Yeah.
And that's just given me the freedom to really interview just a wide variety of people. Some of what I love is interviewing researchers around new research around depression and other mental illnesses.
Yeah.
So I research, you know, I interviewed a researcher from Johns Hopkins on psychedelics and depression, which was really fascinating to me.
I've covered it a little bit too, yeah.
Yeah, a researcher out of Stanford who took TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, and because that is typically a therapy that you have to go to for about 20 minutes, 30 days straight.
Okay.
And it's so time consuming, he's created what is called accelerated TMS. So it's more pulses going through your brain of the magnetic stimulation, and you can, it's less treatments. As well as interviews with women who have had different experiences, you know, a woman who unfortunately lost her son to suicide, and now she is out advocating really kind of against the websites that share, almost promote suicide in ways. And she'll even put in search. She's really good with the SROs, so she'll have certain words that will trigger her website, and it will say things like, I know you came here because you were thinking about suicide, and this is what I need you to know. And she'll promote ways of hope and ways to recover rather than pursue, dying by suicide.
Yeah. And this is not your full-time job, which I think people need to understand, which is you are an assistant principal at an elementary school, correct? And you've worked in education for what, 20 some years, right?
Yep. Over 20 years in education. I've been an administrator for, about 15 or 16 years.
Okay.
So yeah, it is not my full-time job. And I always try to remind myself of that. You know, I remember listening to some podcasts around podcasting, and somebody put a reminder out there, like a podcast coach, like, don't forget, you know, you're competing against people who have teams who put these things together,
exactly,
right? And
exactly.
Keep in mind and don't beat yourself up if your podcast is not as brilliant as, you know, the NPR podcast,
right,
for example.
Right.
Right. And then he played a little trailer from a podcast, and it just went through all of the titles, you know, our main producer, our assistant producer, our sound person, our, you know. So yeah, it's a lot, right? I have a family with four kids. I want to be as present in their lives. I have a full-time job that, a lot of times is more than a 40-hour week. It's always more than a 40-hour week, and sometimes it's bringing work home. And I love the podcasting.
Yeah.
It's seeking out people. You know, it is time-consuming, right?
Yeah.
It's seeking out guests. It's scheduling with guys. It's then interviewing.
Oh, yeah.
It's then editing. It's then publishing. So it can be a lot, but, you know, thankfully, it's something that I just love.
Yeah.
And it really feeds me.
Yeah. And the other part of this that you know, you go into this with a lot of things with your guests and with your blog, that, you know, the recovery process takes engagement. I mean, for a period of time, it takes a lot of engagement. I mean, I came into this field, into my health field, through a back problem. And, you know, even looking back, I was reading some of your blog posts and stuff, and I'm sort of going back through this and realizing, you know, some of my back pain, because I had really kind of started in my teen years, but peaked in about my mid-20s, there, you know, how much of that was, you know, because what ends up happening with mental health stuff and mental and emotional health things becomes physiological at a point. I, you know, as I go back sometimes through some of the, you know, pieces that I had to go through for recovery, I'm realizing more and more just how much of it was kind of mental and emotional, and the manifestations of what that ended up being physiologically for me. Not that I don't have some, I have a foot issue that I think has been, you know, problematic, and a lower spinal issue, but I've basically been pain free for, you know, over 15 years, probably almost getting close to 20 years. So that tells me that there's more than just a physiological, you know, issue going on here. And I treat a lot of, you know, pain issues, and it's so complicated in that way. So, you know, I think one place I'd like to start with you is, I'm sure you've been through this a lot, but because you're so good at sharing what your story was, and one of the things that I think is important for, especially for men, I feel like women will talk to other women about these challenges sometimes, but men don't. And so they sort of suffer in silence for a long period of time. Your story starts somewhere around like 2010, right? When
yeah.
I mean, anything prior to that in your life that you recognize as an episode, a depressive episode?
No, really, really nothing at all. And that first episode, you know, it made sense looking back on it. I was a brand new principal. I had been promoted from an assistant principal. I was moved to a different school within our district. I didn't know anybody. There was no administrative team. So everything was on me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had probably what are typical challenges for principals, but it was a lot for a first year. You know, I came into a school with a budget that was, you know, in a deficit, and I had to cut people before I even met them. Our enrollment was like over the top, tons of kids signing up, and the district wasn't stopping them. So we had huge classes before the school year started, and I was hearing from teachers. And so it was a lot of stress. And then at home, I had a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and 2 newborns. And so, you know,
twins,
I was
right? Don't you have the last ones?
So, you know, up and out of the house before anybody's awake, and I would get home after dinner, and 9 times out of 10 after bedtime too. And I never saw the family. So, but that first year, I started experiencing depression, and I don't know if I was even able to put a finger on it at first.
Right.
I told my brother some of what was going on, and he's a family doctor living in England, but he was a huge support of mine. And all of a sudden I found myself in a doctor's office, you know, 4-foot by 4-foot little office. And this wasn't a common symptom of mine, but I was definitely like fidgety, and I was pacing in the tiny little office and I couldn't sit down.
Yeah.
And the doctor who knew me walked in, and he looked at me and was like, "Whoa, Al, what's going on?" And I shared with him what was going on. And he was like, "Yeah, this is depression. Let's start you on some medication. Let's get you a therapist." And I was able to work through that depression with a therapist, with medication.
Had you had any experience with therapists before that?
No, I hadn't. And the first experience was not the best. And I think my family doctor probably knew it wasn't going to be the best fit, but it was the only one he had to refer me to. He kind of insinuated that it may not work. And, you know, I always tell people, I really strongly believe in therapy, and it's really important to click with your therapist.
Absolutely.
And if you don't, you know, I always, especially when dealing with depression, I think it's good to give them a shot for 2 or 3 sessions.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you're not clicking at that point, find a different therapist. Yeah. Don't give up on therapy, but find a different therapist, because it is well worth shopping around, which can be a real pain and a hassle to go through your story again and tell them everything again.
Yeah.
But in the end, if you meet somebody that you click with and you can trust and share openly, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. So, I managed that depression, and it got pretty bad, but I was able to not take time off of work other than a couple of therapy appointments and, taking the medicines.
What was your experience with the medicine?
Well, it's interesting. My brother was, again, advocating for me as a family doctor. I went in, so my family doctor started me on a typical antidepressant that most family doctors start. patients on. Family doctors, I think, are like, I believe they prescribe like 80% of the antidepressants come from a family doctor.
Oh, that
first
right?
visit with a family doctor. I could be off there. Don't quote that one.
Okay.
But a high amount, right?
Yeah.
And so they have their typical go-tos. And, you know, my brother knew I was a principal in a building. I didn't want to miss work. I was really stressed out. And I also was a bit in fear of, I have to wait 4 to 6 weeks to see if this thing even works.
Yeah.
Right. So my brother was really advocating for me, and he showed me an article out of one of the medical journals that talked about, and I'm not telling people to do this, and of course you work with your doctor around medications, but he advocated for me to get on a Valium type of medicine on a very low dose, to just kind of take the edge off of it so I could still manage work and then cut that out once the antidepressants started kicking in.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was really, it worked well. And I, when I went to a second appointment to advocate for that, my doctor wasn't around. So I had to go to a different family doctor. And I just said, hey, here's an article my brother has showed me. I understand antidepressants can take a long time to start working. I need to get through this 4 to 6 weeks, you know, and the family doctor wasn't hesitant at all. She was like, yeah, let's go for it.
Oh, that's cool.
And you know, it's a medicine that is addictive. And that was a concern of mine too. And so she had me on a low dose, and I was making sure that I was following the directions, you know, and not over medicating myself with them. And I was able to get off of those and stay on the antidepressants. So, yeah, I mean, I really appreciate my family, my brother, my sister, my wife really, really helped me through my depression.
Yeah.
So after, I'll go on a little bit more with my story.
Yeah,
hopefully
yeah,
you can
please.
Edit this out if it's too long. you know, I made it through, and I would say I got better probably in 2 or 3 months. My wife might say it was a little longer. But, and so then I finished up my first year, finished up my second year. I had a different assistant superintendent that was leading me then.
Yeah.
And after 2 years, I chose to take a demotion, a voluntary demotion.
Yeah.
I, you know, wasn't seeing my kids. It was very stressful. So after 2 years, I asked for a voluntary demotion. I went back down to the assistant principal level, and my first year back as an assistant principal in a different school again was fine. It wasn't a great year. The principal was having some issues of her own, so it was a little bit challenging for me to jump into that, and I was an ex-principal, and my mentor became her boss, so there, it was really... It wasn't the best for her, I think, either, and I think she didn't trust me very much because of certain situations like that. And but after that first year, my second year back as an assistant principal started, and I had a new boss because she left the district, and the new boss was fantastic. Got along great with him. I was feeling good. I had a great observation or a great evaluation from him right off the bat, you know, so I knew him in August and September. Had been working together. And then in October, like, everything was going well. My kids were older. I had less stress in my work. And all of a sudden, I could tell that something was going on with my body. And I started to get really worried. And I remember saying to my best friend and to my brother, like, my body feels different.
Mm.
And this isn't going to be good.
Yeah.
And I think I even jumped right back into a therapist and stuff.
Yeah.
Did
you know it was kind of like a related, and did it feel something similar to what you had been through before? Were you worried about like heart attack or, you know, any other physical things or?
No, for me, I felt like it was definitely depression.
Okay.
But I couldn't put a finger on why, right?
Yeah.
Like everything was going so well. But I really felt like it was depression, and it hit really hard. And this depression, I always say, makes my first depression feel like a walk in the park. It was awful.
Were you still on the same medication?
No, I had gotten off medication.
You had gotten off, okay.
Yeah, I had gotten off of medication. But so this one started to get really bad. So it started in October. My brother says about the, like 3 years after my first depression to the day, almost, he looked back at an email when I checked in with him. And, so, you know, I knew things were getting really bad. Like I was really struggling socializing.
Yeah.
And I'm a I'm a fairly outgoing person who can engage in conversations with just about anybody. And the thing I really remember was it was Thanksgiving, November, and we went to some friends of my wife, just a young couple, and we went with our four kids. And I sat at the kitchen island watching everything around me and watching everybody engage, and I couldn't even communicate with anybody. And we got home, and that night my wife and I were talking and just said, you know, if this is what it looks like with friends, what is work like? And I called my boss, and he was an amazing guy. He's still a mentor and good friend of mine today. And I said, you know, I need to meet with you at a coffee shop before work. So we did. I said, hey, I am going through depression. And he said, hey, take the time off you need. And I left that coffee shop. And the first thing he did was call my wife to say, hey, Al told me about his depression. Just know he's on his way home because he was concerned. And that was awesome. So I took 2 weeks off. At this point, I was on a medication and I was trying. I thought, okay, I'll take some time off. I'll adjust my meds. I'll see my therapist.
Yeah.
I ended up taking 2 weeks off, and it was, I call them unstructured weeks, where I had no plans. And it was really, in hindsight, it was awful. I mean, I started like creating a small list, like tomorrow I will do one load of laundry, or I will clean one bathroom. And I couldn't. I couldn't get off my couch.
Yeah.
I didn't want to leave the house, even though I knew that was important, because I didn't want to see anybody in the community who would say, you know, why aren't you at work?
Yeah.
So it was awful, yet. And so I decided, you know, after 2 weeks, okay, I'm going to try to go back to work before winter break. That'll give me like a week to try it out.
Yeah.
It was awful. I was having what they call generalized thoughts of suicide, like nothing specific, but like, I'd rather not be here types of thoughts and stuff. Yeah. And I went to my psychiatric PA who I was seeing and told him, hey, I'm starting to have some some suicidal thoughts. Do you know, could this be the medicine or could this be the depression? And he said, yeah, it could be either. And he upped my dose, which I found out later probably was not a wise choice. My suicidal thoughts then became really pervasive, and I couldn't get them out of my head. Some of the other symptoms too, like I was having uncontrollable crying bouts at night. I'd hold it together at work. I'd hold it together at home with the kids. And then I would just have uncontrollable crying bouts. I wasn't sleeping.
Yeah. Yeah. That's common. Yeah.
I think there were a couple weeks where I had slept like 10 hours for the week. I was losing dramatic weight. I think I lost about 50 pounds because I couldn't eat. I had a giant knot in my stomach. And literally couldn't put food down. But when I had these suicidal thoughts and I found myself doing some really crazy things, like sitting in my room in the dark, and I looked up a website and found a website to how to kill yourself and a rating scale of how many seconds it would take to die and a 0 to 10 for how painful it would be. And I slammed my laptop shut and was like, holy crap,
I can't
believe I'm doing this. Yeah. The other thing I did that was really freaky was looked in a mirror, and luckily I didn't have one on me, but I was trying to figure out the best trajectory for a gun at my head.
Yeah.
And I was in shock that I was at a point where I was doing this right. So then I came up with this plan, and I couldn't get the plan out of my head. And one evening I woke up in the middle of the night and sat up in bed having dreamt of the plan. And then I told my wife and sister that morning, I was like, I need an emergency psychiatric appointment. Please come with me to advocate for me. And I was so glad I asked them, because the psychiatric PA was still wishy-washy. He was like, well, you could take time off, but that could be stressful. And what are you going to do? And what about going back to work? And my sister was like, no, he's taking time off.
Sounds like they didn't read the room very well.
Oh my goodness. And then, so I was so thankful they were there. I ended up checking myself into a partial hospitalization program for 3 weeks, which was an awesome kickstart to my recovery. I mean, it wasn't at all enough to fully recover from a depression like that, but it was a great kickstart. And the other thing I would say about family advocating, I brought my wife with me to check me into the partial hospitalization program. And I was so thankful because, you know, I wasn't thinking straight. And the depression had impacted my cognition, my memory, my focus, everything. And they would ask questions and I'm like, I don't know when I started that medicine. I don't know what, you know, and my wife was there to really help me along. So that really is the story in kind of a nutshell version, believe it or not.
Well, I mean, and so I have a couple quick questions, and you know, I don't like to get money involved in these things sometimes, or the insurance companies, but I'm just curious to know, like, how you navigated all that stuff, or how your family ended up navigating it. Does, you know, was your mental health covered? Your therapist visits covered at the time? And then was this three-week treatment plan covered through, you know, insurance, or was that an out-of-pocket thing?
So that's a great question, and because unfortunately money does prevent some people from getting the treatment they need and deserve, right? So, you know, I have a family, like I mentioned, four kids and my wife, and as an educator, I get some pretty decent health coverage. It's still fairly expensive. But so to see a therapist, you know, I pay a copay until we reached our out-of-pocket. So I had an out-of-pocket maximum. And so we knew that. And I checked myself in January, the beginning of January. And it was like we had to pay out-of-pocket until we hit the deductible. And then the rest was covered because, 3 weeks in a partial hospitalization program is not cheap. But we had reached our out-of-pocket maximum probably in my first week, and we knew and were willing to pay for that out-of-pocket maximum. And then, you know, the rest of the year, we had no more copays or anything. So it worked out really well for us. And as far as, you know, I looked into and had to take FMLA to make sure that I would have a position when I came back to work. And the partial hospitalization program was awesome at helping work through that. They helped me complete some of the forms, fax them to the right people and everything like that. So that was fairly smooth in my case.
And the other question I have is how did you deal with your children? How did you talk to them about this situation?
So that's a great question. So in the beginning, I didn't tell them anything. And they didn't ask questions. They were young enough. You know, my oldest must have been like 8 at that time, and then 5 and 3 and 3. So they were young enough that it didn't
Eight's
really
on the
phase.
Verge of starting to...
Yeah, starting to have some questions and wonderings, right? Because I was all of a sudden, my partial hospitalization program was enough that I was gone during the day, like 9 to 3:30 or so. So my day didn't look too different to them, but I was wondering, you know, hey, I'm not wearing a tie anymore. I wonder if they'll ask about that. Or, hey, dad's dropping me off at school now, because it was a little later, so I could drop them off at school. And, you know, there weren't any questions. When my kids got older, I shared with my oldest one my whole story, essentially. I think everything except for the pieces around suicide. Although now I am willing to and would share that with her. And the 14-year-old knows. And then the twins are still, they're 10 now. And I haven't really, they know that I do a podcast. They know it's around depression. I don't know if they really know the ins and outs of it yet. But, you know, it's something that we really try to talk openly about as a family, our feelings and mental health. My second oldest, we had in therapy from a pretty young age because she just was super emotional with sad feelings and excited feelings. And she was blowing up at home a lot. But it ends up that, it just ends up that she loved her therapist and she still sees her to this day, you know, many years later, not nearly as often, but she loved therapy. She loves the person. So, you know, we used to be like, oh, it's an Angie day. And she loves Angie. And so it's allowed us, you know, to talk about therapy in a really healthy way and to be able to talk about times when we're struggling and how it's not easy and how there is help.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important. My son was in this like group when he was maybe second grader or something like that. And it was, they heard him doing some negative self-talk. And so they had this like therapy group and they said, if that doesn't, you know, work for him, we can get him one-on-one. But kids seem to like this. They turned some of it into games. And so, and what they were doing was really giving them tools like, you know, to understand what the feeling was that they were experiencing. So, you know, then he would start saying to me like, oh, Dad, it really frustrates me when you say, it was like,
right,
thank you for letting me know. But that's the thing, is being able to communicate that to another person, right? We all struggle with this. Maybe I would say in the Midwest, even more.
Yeah.
Could be wrong, because I've lived on the East Coast. I feel like those emotions, people are a little more connected to, and they're willing to have the emotion and apologize for it sometimes too. Whereas here, like a little more stuffed down, even the way that I'm working with people lately through the pandemic, I think people are doing kind of amazing work. I would do a lot of coordinating with mental health. I do kind of osteopathic work and craniosacral therapy, which is really kind of like a mix of you know, really sort of being with that person. It's not energy work, but it's very low force. It's like almost kind of like what osteopathic work is, almost like really low force chiropractic. So what you're doing is you're helping the whole system kind of relax. You know, we work on the breathing systems and we kind of do some coaching through it. And we're also, we're trained to be able to deal with things as they come up. If there's a conversation that, you know, they start to have with you, or they have some memory, or they have a strong image, we know how to work with that. We're not going to do what a therapist does, but at least, you know, sometimes what we're looking for is what change might happen in the body if they're able to express that, whatever is going on.
Right.
Sometimes the expression is just telling you the story. You know, sometimes there's an emotion that goes with it, but I end up doing a lot of that work. So,
fantastic.
That's a piece that I've, you know, I've gotten more interested in, I think, as time has gone on, as I've, you know, talked to you about before. Like there's a piece of the physiological that's going on that I always feel is connected back to an early experience in your life or an emotion or something like that. So was that anything for you that you were able to trace back, you know, to like some of the emotional parts of things that you were struggling with that you might have found in therapy? Did you find anything from earlier in life, or was it really kind of centered around maybe what was happening just at that moment in your life?
Yeah, you know, my therapy has pretty much been about what has been happening at that time. What can I do to get better? What can I do to maintain better mental health?
Yeah.
And never really dug into the past and things.
Can I ask what kind of therapy that you've done
doing? Yeah, it's typically a mix of CBT as well as my current therapist knows a lot about DBT and will sometimes bring in DBT strategies.
Yeah.
And I think he describes his practice as kind of a mix.
Okay. Can you tell us what the acronyms mean for anybody who doesn't know?
Yeah, absolutely. CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy. Yeah. And a lot of that is working with your thought processes, right? Because it's you see an action or something happens, and then we create our own thought about that.
Yeah.
And then oftentimes we start to act and behave based on that thought.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when dealing with depression, even just minor depression, it's easy to get into these negative thought patterns, which can spiral down, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I was taking everything personally that anybody said when I was going through depression. I remember somebody complaining about the schedule to me, and I walked away thinking like, oh my God, they hate me. I'm an awful administrator.
right.
But really the facts were we had a team who made the schedule, and the schedules at elementary levels are crazy these days. Like, it wasn't at all a critique on me, but I could turn it into that. And then, you know.
And it's a new job, right? So you're always going to have like imposter syndrome to some extent that you're struggling with.
Absolutely. Another simple example of CBT is, you know, walking down the hallway, I say hi to somebody and they don't say hello back. And all of a sudden I create my own story. Like they hate me. They're ignoring me, when really maybe they didn't hear me. Yeah. Maybe they just got some terrible news that's on their mind, right? There's all these possibilities.
Oh yeah.
So really CBT is catching those negative thoughts, stopping those thoughts, asking for facts, right? Like I mentioned about the scheduling piece, and then changing that thought into something more positive or workable. And then DBT is dialectical behavioral therapy. And I don't know a ton about it, but it involves, it's part of it is the thought processes and stuff, but it's a lot more skill-based, and it involves learning, like you talked about, breathing strategies, some meditative strategies and mindfulness, and quite a few other strategies like that that I haven't really worked in great detail with DBT. Yeah. But I hear some fantastic things. Most DBT programs I've heard about are almost like a year long, and they're two evenings, the programs I've heard about people attending, two evenings a week. One is a group therapy session, and then one night a week is one-to-one. And a lot of times it's applying the strategies you're learning to your own situation and stuff. And I've heard just amazing things. Several people I know have said, everybody should go through a DBT program. Like, everybody. It's just awesome.
So going back after that 3 weeks that you went through, that kind of jump-started you, what was your recovery process like from there, in terms of like integrating back into work and you know trying to get your social skills back on track and parenting and your marriage and all that stuff? I'm sure you kind of had to work back each of these things.
I decided to schedule a meeting with my boss. And so work-wise, I met with him and just said, hey, I'm coming back. I need you to know that I'm not 100%, but also know that I wouldn't be coming back if I didn't think I could handle it.
Okay.
And he was great. Like, let me know what you need me to take off your plate, and I'm here to support you. And that was awesome. So work was okay. It certainly did take a fair amount of time for me to be comfortable there. At the time I didn't have an outside, or my outside therapist had just was leaving his role. So the partial hospitalization program helped me connect with a psychiatrist and also a therapist. So I continued therapy. I was then working with a psychiatrist. I don't know if you want to get into this or not, but I have a kind of an interesting meds story.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about that, actually.
So at the partial hospitalization program, you start with a new psychiatrist, even if you had one.
Okay.
And they do a quick assessment of your medicines and what you're doing and what's working, what's not, and if you need to make some changes. He changed my antidepressant, but more importantly, he was really concerned about my lack of sleep. Mm. And I think a lot of times sleep is the first thing they want to get control of, because you know, you don't understand how much of your issues are the lack of sleep that can mess you up terribly, or the depression, right? So it was really interesting. I was already on trazodone. Actually, it's an antidepressant that's used very commonly off-label for sleep medicine. And again, I want to reiterate, I'm not promoting. I shouldn't have even mentioned the med name, but not promoting the medicine.
Yeah, gotcha.
So I was on trazodone, and the therapist asked me about my sleep, and I said, you know, when I fall asleep, finally, I sleep pretty well, but it's tough to get to sleep. So I had never heard about a doctor doing this, but he put me on a prescription antihistamine to knock me out, to get me tired before bed, and to continue with the trazodone to keep me asleep once I was asleep.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, I was looking at the trazodone bottle and I took the maximum of whatever they could, whatever the bottle said, of course, because I wanted to get sleep. I knew I needed sleep, right? So all the way through this 3-week partial hospitalization program, my kids were still little. I still had 2 kids in cribs and they would cry, you know, and whatnot. And my wife was really good about like, I'm not going to wake Al. He's going to sleep because he's, you know, trying to recover and he needs it. And I'm sure she was struggling dealing with this depressed guy for a long time too, right? So it was really interesting though, because, so I never got up in the middle of the night. Well, when I left the partial hospitalization program, all of a sudden, my first night out of there, I think it was, one of my kids, my second oldest kid, went downstairs to the main floor and we had an alarm system and the motion detector was on. So the alarm system would beep really high beeps before the sirens would go. And I heard this beep, 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 beep. And so I knew like the alarm all of a sudden was going off. So I shot out of bed. I ran downstairs. I went to the alarm panel and was able to cancel it. But the alarm sound had just kind of started. So I wanted to call the alarm system. And this was like 11 at night. So I started to dial the alarm system. And in my head, I was trying to think, what's my password? They're going to ask for the password. I couldn't think of it. And the phone just kept ringing. And all of a sudden, I woke up and I had passed out and fell. And I woke up like with my face right at the bottom of a coat rack. And I got myself up and I went about 6 feet going towards the upstairs, towards my bedroom. And I fainted again a second time. And then I got myself up. I got to the stairs and I was banging across the walls of the stairs. And my bedroom door where my wife was sleeping was cracked open. I fainted a third time and fell through this door that was cracked open, slamming the door open. My wife was there and the second oldest kid who had started the alarm. And they were both in there looking at me. And I like crawled my way up to the bed and laid on my back. And my wife was like, "You're white." And crazily enough, I slept that night and I was like, I just need sleep. And I went to work the next day. And I was no longer in the partial hospitalization program, but I called that doctor and said, "Hey, I just fainted 3 times. In fact, the first fainting, I messed up my shoulder and still messed up to today. I'm lucky it wasn't a head injury, really."
Right.
But so I called him and he's like, "No way, this is not the medicine because you were on the medicine for 3 weeks and nothing happened. So it can't be the meds." But again, I had never been up in the middle of the night.
And he just
said, "So if it happens again, call 911 and get off the medicines." And he was no longer my psychiatrist because he was only it for that there when I was in the hospitalization program. So 2 nights later, the babies are crying in the cribs. And sure enough, my wife like elbows me like, "Okay, hey, you're done with your program. You're better. You go deal with the crying baby." And I was standing between the 2 cribs and my son was crying. I still remember this. And he was like banging around in the crib and screaming for his mom. And I looked at him and I remember just saying like, "If you don't calm down or I'm just going to leave." And I turned to walk away and I just fainted and landed flat on my face. And my wife heard the clunk and she said she came over and was trying to wake me for a bit of time. And then I woke up, scooted myself to the wall and was leaning against the wall, sitting down with my legs out. And we were both like, "Do we call 911?" Which was kind of scary for us both, but we were told to do that. Instead, my wife called her sister, who also is a family doctor. My wife called my brother, who's a family doctor in England. And both were like, "Yeah, you should probably call 911. So we do, and all this, you know, the medics show up, and I go into the ambulance, and they're putting the heart monitors on me and everything, and I get to the hospital, and they're in the ER, and they're running a bunch of tests and things, and The doctor came back, and I didn't even understand his sarcasm until I left the ER. But he said, yeah, no problem. He said, you know, trazodone, this is the most common side effect we see of trazodone, is people fainting. And he said, you don't have to do a thing at all about your medicines. All you have to do is worry about fainting and knocking yourself on the head and dying. You know, essentially, like, get off that medicine. But again, I didn't understand his sarcasm as I was walking out going, I think he's telling me I should get off these meds.
Yeah, but also maybe not exactly the right time for the sarcasm.
Yeah, exactly. Right on. So I called that therapist from the partial hospitalization program again, and he said, you know, just, you know, he assured me, like, the antihistamine, I believe I didn't even have to wean off. I could just stop, and the trazodone, he told me I should wean. So I worked with another psychiatrist on weaning off of that as quickly as I could. I mean, by guidelines, you know, I think anytime you wean off meds, it's really important to work with a doctor on it, because certain meds, you really have to wean slowly.
And so did you find other ways, like sleep management things for yourself then over time? I mean, because I've had to go through with back pain stuff, you know, I had to go through some of these, you know, meds and stuff too. And luckily none of them suited me very well. So I just kept kind of working on different ways of, you know, dealing with it. And I, you know, things that became much healthier in time. But at the beginning, when you're just struggling with pain, like, you'll kind of do anything.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
But similar to, you know, your situation, sleep, when you're in such a, you know, sleep deprived state, you just have to get that part fixed first. But when you're, you know, passing out, obviously you got to make a shift. So what did you end up figuring out?
Well, so for me, both of those, it worked out really well, because they had put me on a different antidepressant that had been working really well. It's an antidepressant that works for anxiety and depression. And I was able to wean off of those. And just as he had thought, the antidepressant, you know, was doing its job of allowing me to sleep. Okay. Whether that was just by eliminating the anxiety I was dealing with the racing mind at night, or what it was doing. But I was so thankful that I didn't need any kind of sleep meds after that experience.
And where are you at today, like, in terms of medication or in terms of, you know, tools for managing?
So I am seeing a therapist still, which I had stopped for a long time, and then my dad passed away just before COVID. So I decided, well, I'm not depressed with my dad's dying, but I know I'm susceptible to depression. I may as well start seeing a therapist. So I'm still seeing a therapist to this day. Now I'm only, you know, at first it was weekly and then twice a month, and now I'm just seeing him monthly. But I'm still seeing a therapist. I started, you know, you had mentioned FaceIt Foundation, which is phenomenal. I still go to the men's support group for depression and anxiety every other week, which is awesome. I am still on one medicine that I take, and my therapist has talked about weaning me off. And I'm kind of like, you know, if it's one of the things that's helping me, because I you know, I am scared as hell to go back to. I mean, I don't live in fear of it, so I don't want to say it like that, but I never want to be where I was. And, you know, it may sound a little cliche, but I would never wish my worst enemy to be in a place where I was.
Right.
So that's enough fear for me to think, like, if this antidepressant is helping me and it's one of my tools, I'm fine with it. And maybe there will be a time I want to wean off, and I'll figure that out, you know. A lot of times it's difficult with different stressful times coming up at the job and stuff that I decide it's tough to figure out a really good time for it. And then, you know, I'm still, I try to exercise. Usually I am like many men, I think, where it comes in waves. Like, I'll be really good for a few months of exercise.
But you're a parent of four as well. So
right.
Catch a little slack.
and most recently my brother, so I did go to a family doctor, which men often neglect, and I had for a long time as well. And I called my brother, the family doctor, and I was like, oh my God, like, everything is red flag, like blood pressure, all my cholesterol and everything, which has always been a little high for me for a long time. But And my brother just said, you know, if you were to lose, because I'm a heavy dude, if you were to lose 10, 15, maybe 20 pounds, I bet all those numbers would come down. And he talked to me about a whole food plant-based diet. And I've been on that since the beginning of March. So I'm also, you know, eating way healthier, trying to exercise quite a bit. We have an elliptical. And then the men's support group. So I'm doing quite a bit.
Yeah.
In addition, you know, the podcast, you know, it's finding a hobby that you love.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, I love the podcast. I love the mental health advocacy work I do, and that kind of feeds me.
So tell me about this. I know you just got appointed by the governor of Minnesota to a council here, correct?
Yeah. Yep. So it's been about a year now, I think, that I've been on the State Advisory Council for Mental Health, which has been a great experience.
How did that happen?
It's an application process.
Okay.
And so, so they have... they have different positions that come up, like community members, therapists.
Yeah.
They try to have a wide variety of people. And I saw an opening and thought I would go for it. And so that's been an amazing experience. And from there, I learned about the state mental health task force. I'm sorry, the state suicide suicide prevention task force.
Okay.
And so I'm on the suicide task force as well for the state. And that's been a great experience as well. So yeah, I'm just trying to, you know, stay in the mental health field as much as possible while I'm working my full-time job. And, and actually, you know, there are a lot of overlaps. And, you know, one of the things I've been advocating for even well before the pandemic was better systems of mental health support for educators.
Yeah.
Because we don't have enough for our kids. We have an overwhelming amount of needs for our kids, but at least everybody's talking about it and trying to problem solve about it and get more school-based therapy, for example. But nobody talks about the mental health of educators. I think with the pandemic, they are starting to.
Yeah.
But it is something that I have talked about for a long, long time, and it's not getting any better.
The mental
health of our educators is in a dire situation right now, I believe. And, you know, you can see it by the numbers of educators who are leaving. We've had more educators leave in the U.S., I think, more educators leave the public school system mid-year than any other year.
Yeah.
And we're seeing the same here in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Educators are leaving. We can't fill positions because nobody's applying for them.
Yeah.
We've had 3 paraprofessional openings for special ed the entire year with 0 candidates.
Wow.
And then we have had, you know, staff members out a lot for their own health or their mental health and whatnot. And we typically are short, you know, 4 to 6 teachers without subs.
Yeah.
So then we're piecing together a hodgepodge of teachers who are losing their prep time, the only time they have to plan and do their work. And they're losing that and working in other classrooms. And, you know, the stress just builds and builds and builds.
Yeah.
So it's been tough. And I think we can do better for our educators. And I really think we have to.
Yeah. I'm so glad you're doing that work. And, you know, if you look back at the history, I mean, I had teachers who were pretty cruel when I was younger. I went to a Catholic grade school too, so that probably didn't help. But I also think that, like, we didn't have these tools. We didn't have the, you know, the understanding of, you know, CBT and all these things, you know, back then to know even how we were processing, you know, the struggles, the challenges of our workplace. And so I think it's slowly, you know, probably evolved. People have learned to take care of themselves a little bit better. But then you throw something like a pandemic and health professionals are the other, you know, group right now that I think is really, really struggling mental health wise. In my practice, I mean, I treat a lot of therapists and I treat a lot of educators and I treat a lot of health professionals. So
that's
been the bulk of you know, the big shift that's happened just through the pandemic for my practice.
Yeah,
so absolutely. It's pretty clear.
Yeah. And, you know, people don't really think about it, but the educators are dealing with the kids and their behaviors, right? Tons of our urban kids are going in and out of complex trauma on a daily basis. And we're hearing these stories from the kids. We're seeing how their behaviors manifest. It's a lot on our educators, and our educators have zero time in the day to process. Right. So, I mean, they may even be dealing with a suicidal kid, and then it's like, okay, we've got them to the social worker now. Good luck with the rest of your day. Yeah. You know, keep going with that math lesson. Yeah. And there's no time to process. They are stuck in the building all day long. You can't go out, really.
Right.
So, yeah, it's just, it has been a lot on our educators. And I think we're going to have to start acknowledging it. And I think there has been some acknowledgement of it. We're losing too many educators to the job. And, you know, we've seen some suicides as well. Yeah. And it's just, we can't keep going this way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for sharing your story, because I think, you know, people need to know that, like, what they're going through sometimes, it may not be to the extreme that you were. You know, sometimes I feel lucky with my situation that I had physiological symptoms that sort of made me change. You know, I mean, it sounds like
for
it was similar for you. I mean, obviously you had more of the mental and, you know, stuff going on as well, and you know, the sleep issues. But those kinds of things can be real catalysts. I mean, it's, well, you know, what I was saying earlier, I feel like I see people also doing really good work. And it's usually because they've hit, maybe they haven't hit a complete bottom, but they've hit a wall of some sort where they're like, I have to face this thing and deal with it right now. And
And
you know, when that happens, that I think people had some time, you know, especially like late 2020 or early 2021, I feel like since then I'm starting to see some things pop up that are like, this person's not doing as well, you know?
So,
you know, but luckily we've developed a rapport and a conversation around some of these things, so we can really, you know, get back into if they need to see their therapist again or do something else.
But building that relationship with you is so important, right? Yeah. So that they can trust you and they're able to share that with you maybe before reaching out to a therapist or somebody.
Yeah. And it's part of the reason why, as you were saying, like, don't give up on, you know, and on that therapist from, you know, just because you didn't have a great therapist, you know, situation to start out with. But the same could be said of any of the people in your team. I mean, I see an acupuncturist and I see, you know, a physical therapist, and I see all these different people. They start to know you in a certain way. And sometimes they might challenge you and say, hey man, you just seem a little off. What's going on?
Right.
You know? I trust that with those people if I've worked with them for a long time. So that also makes me feel like supported, you know, if something like that's going on.
So
it's important, just, you know, I try to, you know, promote this a lot, to just, you know, build a team around yourself. And that team could also be, you know, close friends and family members, as you were lucky enough to have in this situation.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. The team is huge and important. Right. And, you know, the data shows that most people live for 10 years with depression before they reach out for help, which is outrageous. Yeah. And I'm hoping that's starting to change the more we see people talking more about it.
Yeah. Well, for anyone who wants to, you know, hear some of these people that you're talking to, especially now, some of the science behind all of this, as well as people sharing their stories. I think sometimes you know, even for me, I feel like I pick up on something that I relate to usually, and try to get as much, you know, learn as much as I can about that situation if I relate to a story in health, whatever it is. And I feel like, you know, when we first met and talked, pre-pandemic, I mean, it's like, seems like forever ago now, but I felt like, I see how, you know, why we would have an easy conversation, because there's some kind of work that you have to do through this process. And then I think once you get through something like that, there is this sense of like, I'd like to help, you know, somebody else in the way that I feel like I was helped. Or sometimes you're still looking for answers, and that, you know, I always think there are these selfish motivations that actually do end up helping other people too. So don't feel bad if you just feel like you really need to focus on yourself right now.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Al. I really appreciate it. And for anyone who wants to check out your show, it's Depression Files. You also have a website now. Is it depressionfiles.com?
Yep, the depressionfiles.com. And there they can find the blog, they can find the podcast. I also kind of wrote out my entire story. That was my first blog post. So that's there as well.
Yeah. And some of your stuff is up on Huffington Post and some other psych
articles
and stuff too. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and I'm going to put links for all this stuff up on, you know, if anyone who's listening wants to just, you know, scroll down to the show notes, there'll be links to a lot of Al's stuff there too.
Awesome. And, you know, sorry to interrupt you, Jeremy. Yeah. I was lucky enough. Just less than a week ago, I was highlighted in the Min Post. They did an article about myself and the podcast too.
So I saw that
article too. Yeah.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, that was I was really excited about that.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing with us today, Al.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Better with Dr. Erica, hosted by Dr. Erica, provides support and guidance in navigating stress-related challenges to transform your relationship to self-care. Each episode arms you with the tools needed to be better, do better, and live better. There was an incredible episode that you should check out called Touch and Connections as Tools for Healing and Better Mental Health. In this episode, her guest breaks down ways to use physical touch as a form of healing for trauma and grief. Check out Better with Dr. Erica on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.